last week, we ended here. We're going to pick up here on these words here in Romans 3 and continue our analysis through this really good book of the Bible, really helpful book of the Bible. I'm going to read 19 down through 22, and you'll notice I'm actually going to stop without reading the last two words of last phrase of 22, because I believe that the last few last phrase actually goes with verse 20, 23. There's no different Greek texts have different things we would notice. Some have punctuation, some do not. The oldest and really the most common manuscripts of Greek contain no punctuation. And so really, you can't really know for sure, and actually no capitalization, or it's all in capital, either all in lowercase or all in capital. There's no like notice of sentence endings or stuff like that. And so textual critics, they compiled the text based upon the context, not based upon the punctuation or capitalization. And it seems like this one, I think there was a little bit of an error in how they compiled and how translators translated it. So you'll see why in a minute. 19, now we know that whatever the law says, it says to those who are under the law, that every mouth may be stopped and all the world may become guilty before God. Therefore, by the deeds of the law, no flesh will be justified in his sight, for by the law is the knowledge of sin. But now the righteousness of God apart from the law is revealed, being witnessed by the law and the prophets, even the righteousness of God through faith in Jesus Christ to all and on all who believe. This verse 20, therefore in verse 20, is not just a connector, a coordinating conjunction that connects, preposition, there we go. Connecting pronoun is not just what connects this with the previous verse. This actually is the implication or the inference of 1 through 3. Everything that we read up to this point in Romans is leading to this statement. So really, verse 20 is the first major declaration by the Apostle Paul in his letter, outside of the opening part of his letter where he's saying the gospel is the power of God to salvation. This is the first major declaration. And so it is the declaration that everything else has been building to. So what has everything been building to that he has been saying in chapter 1 and 2? The answer to that is found in the end of verse 19. And it's really simple. It is this. Everyone is guilty before God. That's the argument of chapter 1 with the Gentiles, right? And then that's the argument of chapter 2 with the Jews. So what do you think he means when he says, and this is just important for us to see contextually, all the world, contextually? Jews and Gentiles, right? Now, of course, it also means all the world in the sense of, Americans and Chinese and Brazilians, yes, all the world. But in the understanding of Pauline writing, of an apostolic writing in that world, the world is comprised of either Jews or Gentiles, right? That was the great distinction the Jewish people made, either a Jew or a Gentile. So they don't mean, well, all the Jews and Gentiles, and maybe some other group too. They mean, yeah, all included in that. But that distinction, Jew-Gentile issue, that binary distinction is going to run through the entire book of Romans. So because of that, we have to make sure that we're constantly thinking of that phrase world in Romans as referring to Jews and Gentiles, because they'll use it to kind of create an argument throughout the book. So everyone is guilty before God. We didn't become guilty because we sinned, though. How did we become guilty before God? And this is also important. We were guilty, right? So what does he mean, become guilty? Okay, revealed. This is really important as it relates to the next words he's going to talk about. How is he using the concept of guilt here? Okay, violation of the law. He's using it in a forensic term. Okay, he's using it. See, we were guilty, right? He's not using it in an actual term, like we weren't guilty before. I mean, we didn't sin, and then suddenly we sinned, right? He'd been saying all along that we always sinned, but we just didn't realize that our sin made us guilty before God in a legal sense. The law shows us our sin makes us guilty in a legal sense. That's what he's getting at here when he says become guilty. So he's not talking about that we entered into a state of guiltiness. He's saying we entered into the verdict of guilty. The judge said, you're guilty. The criminal who commits the crime, is he guilty? When is he guilty? Oh, he's guilty when he commits the act of the crime, right? When does he suffer the consequences for his guilt? When the judge tells him you're guilty, right? So even if he's guilty, he's regarded, in our culture, in our system, he's regarded as not guilty, right? We use that big, it's an important part of our legal system, innocent until proven guilty. Is he really innocent? No, he's regarded as innocent. He's treated as innocent until he's declared to be guilty. So the important reason why I bring this up is this is setting up the next word he's going to talk about, the very important theological word in the next verse. Because if he's talking about declared guilt in verse 19, then he's talking about declared righteousness in verse 20. If he's not talking about actual guilt in verse 19, something we already had, he's not talking then about actual righteousness in verse 20. Yeah, let's get to verse 20 then. Therefore, by the deeds of the law, no flesh will be justified in his sight. Do you see how before God and in his sight, those are parallel ideas? Guilty before God or justified before God. That's the real thing. So he's not talking about guilt as far as the world is concerned, nor is he talking about righteousness as far as the world is concerned. He's not talking about guilt as far as your conscience decides, nor is he talking about righteousness as far as your conscience decides. So in other words, he's saying it doesn't matter whether you feel guilty or you feel righteous. That's not what he's talking about. It doesn't matter whether everyone thinks you're guilty or everyone thinks you're righteous. He's saying what he's getting at, and this is a very important theological part of the doctrine of salvation, what matters is, in the eyes of God, does he see you as guilty or does he see you as righteous? That's what the word justified means. The word justified, just like that phrase become guilty, the word justified is a forensic term. It is a legal term. It is not an actual term. He doesn't say that we will be actually righteous in his sight, in the sense that we become sinlessly perfect in his sight, or sinlessly perfect as it relates to our actual activities of life. He's using this term justified, dikaiosune, righteousness or declared righteousness, to refer to the legal idea that he, as the judge, says not guilty. Now, here's the important part of that legal declaration. If, and this is our system of laws, is based upon the biblical system of laws, but not just the biblical, Paul is referring to the Greco-Roman system here. Not necessarily the Jewish system even. He's referring to the Greco-Roman system. That is where we get our system, right? As far as the law, what do you mean? I'm talking about all guilt. The way a criminal is treated for his actions, whether it's Jewish law or Gentile law. So our legal system comes, right, our democratic, republican, represented, that type of stuff comes from the Greek and Roman world, which came through the Western civilization, which came to us. One of the unique features that is true in both situations is this. If the individual does indeed commit the crime, But because of the arguments of the lawyer or whatever the case may be, right? The judge declares him not guilty. Do you know that's really important aspect of our legal system? What is true as at the end of that? What if the criminal, after he is declared not guilty, what if he stands up in court and says, I fooled you all, I really did it? It doesn't matter, right? Now, they'll probably try to find something else to get him for, right? But legally speaking, can they say, oh, never mind, let's go back and retry this case? No, because when the judge declares, the jury informs the judge declares the jury's verdict, when it's declared not guilty, it is legally declared, it is irreversible for that specific crime, right? That's an important part of our legal system. We get that from the Greco-Roman legal system. That's what Paul is making a connection to in this. He's saying it doesn't matter whether they actually committed the crime or not. In God's sight, one can be as good as innocent, declared righteous, declared not guilty before God, but not by what? Not by the works of the law. Not by doing the law. And he gives this little parenthesis here. Why? What's the law do? The law gives knowledge. The law tells us what's wrong, but it doesn't actually fix what's wrong. I heard this great illustration in that recent movie that I've kind of, for different people, I've tried to kind of encourage people to see, called The American Gospel. An individual made this, I think, good illustration. He said, the law is a mirror to show us God and to show us ourselves. He says, no one ever that he's ever known has gone to a mirror and seen something stuck in his teeth and then used the mirror to try to get what's in his teeth out. You know, you don't use the law to try to fix the problem. You use the law to see the problem. And I think that sort of illustration here is what he's saying here. The law gives me the knowledge. It can't make me righteous. My religious deeds can't make me righteous. They can't declare me. God doesn't say, well, they've done religious deeds, so I'll say not guilty. So he's going to now then explain how it can be that somebody who is guilty, because here's the difference between our example, the illustration from current culture and the illustration from the Bible. The big difference is what? In the legal courtroom, why do we even have a trial? Because we really don't know, right? Now, some people know, the victim knows, right? And the perpetrator knows, but everyone else is taking, or a witness knows, right? But everyone else is taking their word for it and trying to argue their case. But is our guilt before a human judge? In this illustration. Nope, remember? Before God. So, is there a trial? Well, not in the same sense, right? Not a trial in order to find out, a fact-finding trial. The reality is the judge actually knows that all the world is guilty, right? He knows that. He knows we're guilty, and yet he still, in his sight, will justify, will declare righteous. We'll get to this throughout the text. This is probably one of the most important texts in the book of Romans, this section here. We'll get to how that can be at the end. So he's going to go by now down and say, how is it possible for an already condemned person to be declared righteous in the sight of God when God knows? How is it possible? And he uses this phrase. Now notice this, righteousness of God. He'll say it again. Now the righteousness of God, apart from the law, is revealed, being witnessed by the law and prophets, even the righteousness of God through faith in Jesus Christ to all and on all who believe. This phrase, righteousness of God, is not referring to the knowledge of God that God is a righteous God. It's not, but now the God who is righteous That's not what he's talking about. He's talking about in the context, this word, phrase, righteousness of God, is the righteousness that comes from God. Or, this is the same word, same idea. So he's using this phrase, the righteousness of God here is the phrase justification. So it's God's declaration of righteousness. So say it that way when you read it. But now, God's declaration of righteousness, so this justification, apart from the law, is revealed, or not shown to be, but is now given us freely, is revealed. And this is an important phrase. I'll switch my colors here so that we can see the difference. Being witnessed by the law and the prophets. You see, he's continuing the theme of a courtroom. And what's the important aspect of the courtroom? You have the judge, you have the guilty party, and generally, in many situations, you would have the offended party. And who else would be in that courtroom? Well, in ours, a jury. We're not talking about a jury system, though, because we're talking about God as the judge and jury both, right? But witnesses, right? And here's what he's saying. He's actually saying this. He's saying the law and the prophets. What does law and the prophets stand for when it's found in the New Testament? The Old Testament, right? The Old Testament. Yeah, it's referring, but when it's paired with prophets, it's generally referring to more than the Mosaic Law. It's referring to the Mosaic Law plus. So the Mosaic Law plus, so the Old Testament, the entirety of the Old Testament. Throughout the, Jesus used this often to refer to the Old Testament, law and prophets, law and prophets. So he says the Old Testament functions as a witness, but not just of guilt. Because what is he saying is witnessed by the law and the prophets? Okay, yes, shows God's righteousness, but this phrase I don't think is referring to God's righteousness as it so much is the righteousness that God gives. Okay, yeah, he's saying the Old Testament witnessed justification. In other words, he's saying the idea that a sinner can be righteous before God is not first found in the New Testament. So, the Old Testament is not all about God's angry, and the New Testament all about God's happy. He's saying the idea, the theological concept that you, a sinner, can be righteous before God is witnessed by the law and the prophets. Well, he's actually going to get into this in chapter 4 because he's going to give some examples of some people in the Old Testament who were justified, but not by the keeping of the law. He's going to talk about how one particular individual named David received this wonderful justification by the process called, see if anybody wants to jump ahead, the theological term. Come on. Imputation. Like, actually, that's how it takes place, but we're jumping ahead. All right, let's back up. So this righteousness of God, or this justification before God, now I want to pause just to make sure we're all on the same page. Does everyone understand what I mean when I say justification? I know I've explained it, but I think this is so important we don't get wrong. It means the legal act of God declaring sinners righteous. It doesn't mean that we stop, that it's like we actually didn't sin, but it means that God views us legally as if we didn't sin. Doesn't mean we actually won't sin, but it means that God views us as if we won't sin. That's justification. It's not the same thing as sanctification. It's not. It's the same salvation, but not the same angle, not the same diamond in salvation, same gem. It's a separate one. He will get to that as well in Romans. So this justification, then if it doesn't come by the deeds of the law, but it was witnessed by the law and the prophets, how then does it come? How can a sinner be declared righteous before God? And I know we all know this because many of you in church grew up in church and you grew up hearing this, but I want us to see it in God's holy word, how simple and plain it is, because he says it so simply. How does it happen that a sinner can be righteous before God? It can't be any clearer than this. Look at the words. Through faith in Jesus Christ. Through faith in Jesus Christ and getting baptized and becoming a part of the church and being obedient. Is that what it says? How is a person declared righteous before God? Through faith in Jesus Christ. What does it mean to have faith in Jesus Christ? Well, let me tell you what it means to have faith in Jesus Christ. Just repeat it again. To all and on all who believe. Now, there's a textual variant here. Some texts have on all. Some texts just say to all who believe. The reality is it's just whatever text is correct, I'm not sure. It doesn't change the meaning. It's just emphatic. It's not like one's kind of to all, but then on all. It means the same thing. To all who believe. Right. So exactly, and a great point. See, this is the problem. People, it's not that this people don't agree with you. Many people, even religious people, say, oh, I agree with that. But when you try to nail down this, that's where you get trouble, right? Because it becomes a faith plus. Well, don't, but you also have to do the deeds of the law. If you, and this is what Galatians was about, if you add to Jesus Christ anything of our performance as a means for justification, you erase Jesus Christ and faith in him. There is no such thing as faith plus doing something to gain justification. Faith plus, or Christ plus doing something to gain justification. This right here is super important, though. I can't see what I'm doing. This right here is super important. Who is that? Because that go back to what Beth just said. There's a lot of people who would say they have faith in Jesus Christ, but the question would be, well, define for me Jesus Christ. Who is Jesus? If he's not the Jesus Christ as revealed in the Bible, then this is useless. Because it's not just faith, it's faith in this objective person and work alone. And so that's key. You can't take any of these words out, right? They're all super important. Now, let's move on. Oh, I have this little diagram that I was going to put up there before you, but I essentially did it all through the word, so we'll just skip it for now. We'll move on. Now, I think this goes with verse 23 better. For there is no difference. What does he mean, there is no difference? Well, this is what he means, there is no difference. For all. No difference then between what? Jew and Gentile. So there's no difference between Jew and Gentile. This is the application of what he's been setting up in chapter 1 and chapter 2, right? The Gentile's pretty rotten, and the Jew who thinks he's pretty good finds out he's pretty rotten. There's no difference, Jew and Gentile. All have sinned, so that what makes all what? Guilty, and fall short of the glory of God. Now, this is an interesting verse. This is one we quote all the time. All have sinned and fall short of the glory of God. That idea, fall short, many have described it this way. We've missed the mark. It's the idea of an archer shooting an arrow, and they've missed. But here's the question I have. Why does this matter? I mean, because he adds that in here. We knew this. He's already said this clearly, right? All have sinned. We're guilty. But he adds this. And because of our sin, right? Because of our sin, right? We fall short. What is that telling us about humanity? Okay. What that's telling us is that sinning itself is not only the problem. It's what sinning produces. Sinning destroys. Sinning destroys the divine purpose for which we were created. God created Adam and Eve with divine purpose. He blesses them and he commands them in the garden, right? Be fruitful, multiply, replenish the earth, have dominion over the fish of the air, over the birds, over the thing. And that dominion is not just that they were to rule things and they ruined the rule. The idea of having dominion is they were created in the image of God, being created in the image of God. The likeness of God was not an essential likeness, meaning they were like God in his essential attributes and his godness, but they were like God in his mission. God's mission was to have dominion, to rule this earth that he made it, and he gave man as image bearers to rule in his place. In other words, the purpose of man was to represent God. Purpose of man was to represent God in his world. And what does sin do? Well, that does not represent God, right? That's why we say the image of God, the representation, the likeness was marred. No longer does man represent God. Instead, he represents the one who Jesus says is really now his, metaphorically speaking, father. Who did man have as his father when he chose sin? Satan. Man represents Satan. That's harsh. We represent Satan without Christ in our fallen state. So we represent. Jesus told the Pharisees this, right? Who were very religious people. You are of your father, the devil. And why does he use the word father? Not because they were the offspring of him. He's not using the word father in that sense. He's using the word because he says, because you do the works of your father, right? He was a liar from the beginning. And what is he then saying about them? You lie. He was a murderer. And what are they trying to do? Murder him, right? Essentially, he's saying the children look like their father. Mm-hmm. Right. Right. He's saying you look like your father, right? You represent him. And the reality is we were called to represent God. We were called to reflect God. We were called to be glorious, not in ourselves, but as an expression of the glory of God. But Adam and Eve actually pursued the glory of themselves. They didn't pursue the glory of Satan. Satan didn't come and says, worship me, and they worshiped him. Satan came to them and said, worship yourselves. And they were very glad to do that. And that's exactly what our fallen world does. Worships itself. So here's the important thing. Sin perverts our ability to worship. For all have sinned, and thus we fall short of the purpose of worship that God created us for. What does that then tell you by implication happens if this is taken care of? Our purpose is restored. Now we can glory, live for the glory of God. That's why he justifies us. This is what he goes on to say. Being then, what? Justified. So here's the problem. Sin has destroyed our purpose in worship. Justification restores our purpose in worship. Then what would you naturally think would follow a truly justified person? True worship. Right? What did Jesus say? This isn't Pauline. This is Jesus. What did Jesus say in John chapter 4? God is spirit, and they that worship him must worship in spirit and truth. He is, and I'm paraphrasing before that, he said this, he is seeking worshipers. He's seeking such worshipers to worship him. But what does God find when he looks over the earth? Does he find worshipers? We're worshipers of him. Does he find worshipers of him? What does he find when he sees our hearts? Worshippers of ourselves, right? So what's the ultimate purpose in salvation? What's the ultimate purpose in justification? To create worshipers. And I'm not talking about, we understand we're talking about worship in a broad sense. We're not talking about what you do on Sunday. That's important, but that's not it, right? To worship means to you ascribe worth, that you give your life to that cause. You worship the ground someone walks upon. You talk about that, right? It's, if you were to say that this person worships the ground someone walks upon, we're not saying they every now and then they think about them, We're saying that this is their life. That's what worship is. A person whose profession of faith does not produce worship of the one true God in Jesus Christ ought to be concerned about said profession of faith. They ought to be, because justification restores that fallen image. Because now we're no longer guilty before God. Now the righteousness of God is on us. And so it restores the worship in us and the heart of worship and the focus of worship. Okay, being justified. But this is crazy because we are sinners, right? I mean, let's not forget when we think about all these glorious things, let's not forget the fact that how can God do this? How can God simply say, oh, just believe in Jesus Christ and all will be well? How is that possible? Salvation is so simple. Justification is so simple. Here's the reality. Justification or salvation is the most complex act and work in all of eternity. It's offered simply, but it is a convoluted act that is without understanding. I mean, it is complex. And that's what we actually see here. Here's the thing. The complexity is not on the offer. The complexity is on God's part. He took care of the complexity of it all, and he offers it how? How could he offer something so free? Because he's a gracious God. He's a God of grace. What does it mean when we say that God is God of grace? What do we mean by that? You know what that means? The idea of grace is the idea, we often know the textbook definition, right? Unmerited favor. Great. But think about it. What is grace? Grace is the idea. It is the beautiful idea that everything that I am that is bad is overlooked in order to overshadow me with everything that I am not, which is good. It's the idea that, when we talk about this, people misuse it all the time, and they say to an individual like, "Well, you seem like a nice person. We can show you some grace in this matter." That's the exact opposite of grace. Like, grace is when you're saying you're the worst person, so I'll show you grace in this matter. Grace doesn't come to the partially good. Grace only comes, and the definition of grace is God's overshadowing love and acceptance upon the worst of the worst. Grace is the opposite of any sort of activity on man's part.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Right, and that's exactly, but wait, I thought the Old Testament was all the wrath and anger stuff and the lightning bolts from heaven. The law and the prophets witness justification by grace, right? It's not a New Testament concept. Here's what, and he's going to say in a minute what the New Testament adds to this. But the idea of grace and the idea of justification, the idea of forgiveness, that's all throughout the Old Testament. Okay, let's move on here. He's gracious because he's gracious. Okay, he gives us grace because that's his nature to do. But how can the grace of God come upon sinners and it actually be effective? How can it be effective to make God pleased with sinners? I mean, does God get amnesia? I mean, is it just that he's like, well, bless their hearts, they try so well, I'll show him a little grace. He's very knowledgeable of just how wicked we are, right? There's no forgetfulness in God. He hasn't somehow come to this place where he's decided, they're like these little flies that I guess I can show a little pity on. He knows who we are. He knows our frailty, and that ought to scare us to death. Right? This is how he shows grace. This is the way in which he shows grace in justifying us. He gives us redemption. But it's not just any redemption. It's redemption. In Christ Jesus. Okay, this will be a theme here. Whom? Who? Jesus Christ is also what? He's the propitiation. We'll get to that word in just a minute. By his blood through faith. To demonstrate just how much we're worth it. Why does God redeem sinners? To demonstrate just how worth it he is. That's why worship is the natural produce of true justification. Because true justification doesn't make me look at myself and say, boy, I'm worth it. True justification makes me look at myself and look at him and say, boy, he's worth it. That's what justification does. That's what true salvation brings. Why? Well, because in his forbearance, that's grace, mercy, that's the fact that he chose to hold back judgment when he could pour it out. In his forbearance, God had passed over sins that were previously committed. Now, he's talking now historically. Okay, he's not talking about the individual here. He's saying in history, God didn't, and this goes back to the issue of the Old Testament, grace. God didn't give Noah what he deserved. He didn't give Cain what he deserved, right? He didn't do that. He showed grace. He showed forbearance. He passed over sins. But here's the problem. If God is passing over sins and he's the judge of the earth who knows everyone's sins, what sort of God does that make him? Unjust. At the root of it all, and this is what people struggle with, and I'm not going to disagree with them on it. I just don't think they understand the full story of the gospel. Salvation through faith in Jesus Christ alone is unjust. It's not right. Faith shouldn't be enough. Now, I'm speaking as a man in human terms, okay? We're going to read the rest of the verse. We're not done yet, okay? And isn't that what many people argue with when it comes to the simplicity of the gospel? So you're telling me that somebody can live their whole life as a wicked person and they just say, I'm sorry, and I believe in Jesus now, and all that's wiped away? And you're saying that I, who have lived a pretty decent life, that I believe in Jesus, and the murderer who does not live, he believes in Jesus, that we're the same? Isn't that what people's problem is with justification by faith alone? Isn't that what people often say? Have you heard anything like that? They're not totally wrong. They're not totally wrong. Like, that doesn't make sense, does it? From a human perspective. Like, yeah, it seems like, how could that be the case? But they didn't keep reading in Romans 3, okay? Because here's what happened. In the past, it may have appeared that he was unjust, right? It may have appeared that was incorrect. But at the present time, he's talking now in the New Testament period, in our period, at the present time, he has still demonstrated his righteousness. He still demonstrates it. So he demonstrates his righteousness in this way. How does he demonstrate his righteousness? Well, this is how, going back up here. By Jesus Christ redeeming sinners by becoming the propitiation for them. That's how he demonstrates his righteousness. By Jesus Christ redeeming sinners by being the propitiation for them. So what does the word propitiation mean? It is from the Greek word hilasmion. It is a difficult word, translated in many places, or could be translated in many ways. It can be translated atonement, could be translated expiation, could be translated appeasement, reconciliation. this little phrase right here helps us know how we should translate it. It is a certain sort of appeasement, but an appeasement that is what? Yeah, appeasement based upon death. Bloody death, right? Appeasement based upon bloody death. This goes back to the idea of grace, appeasement. Reconciliation based upon death. Essentially, here's the idea. No, faith alone is not enough to save a sinner. Faith alone is not enough to save a sinner. It's got to be faith in one who died for the sinner. In other words, it's not the faith that saves us. It's Jesus who saves us. It's Jesus who paid the price. It's Jesus who atoned for us. Faith is merely the acceptance of Jesus in our place. Faith is not strong. Faith is not powerful. Faith is not an amazing thing. And everybody says that faith is just, the faith is strong. Faith is, and every time Jesus came, did he ever talk about strong faith when he was on earth? I mean, what word always accompanied the, or seemed to always accompany the word faith when he described it in the little, right? Yet those with little faith, were they justified? Yeah. Was it because they had just a little, or it was all because the faith itself was not what justified, right? Jesus justifies. His death in our place, his propitiation, his blood being shed, pays the criminal's verdict. It pays it completely. Redeems. Buys it back as done. Complete. Settled. So his righteousness is intact. God's righteousness is intact because he doesn't just forgive people based upon grace. You know what I mean by that? God just doesn't go, well, I guess I'll be a forgiving God. He doesn't forgive people based on grace. And he doesn't forgive people based on their faith. If that were the case, then those who had more faith would have more forgiveness, right? If it's based upon faith. He forgives us based upon the propitiation of Jesus Christ, the eternal God, become man. Because of God's grace, we have access by faith. So don't diminish grace and faith. But understand, the object of faith is the most central part of the whole thing. The person, Jesus Christ, is the central to it. It is the grace of God to give us Jesus, and it is the faith that God gives us to believe in Jesus, but it's all about Jesus. That's where our justification comes from, because he paid the price. He paid the price. So it may seem at first unjust, but it's not unjust, because in the gospel, he is just. He judges sinners, and he is the justifier, because he judges sinners on Jesus instead of them. And so he's both just and justifier to the one who receives Jesus, believes Jesus, rests in Jesus. All the terms used, Jesus himself eats and drinks Jesus. Right now, the terms he uses for that same concept, receiving Jesus. There. We can't get on to the rest of this because we're out of time. But the next question is so obvious. So who are you going to boast in? when are you going to say, but I don't even start, right? Let's pray and be dismissed.